There have been, in recent years, there's been an escalating drumbeat of calls for the profession to, the profession of medicine and the state to rein in what have come to be called conscientious refusals or conscientious objections. More than a decade ago, the bioethicist Julian Savulescu, who heads up a center at Oxford, wrote in the British Medical Journal that a doctor's conscience has little place in the delivery of modern medical care, and that if people are not prepared to offer legally permitted, efficient, and beneficial care to a patient because it conflicts with their values, they should not be doctors. A few years later, the American Congress of Obstetrics and Gynecology, known as ACOG, issued a position statement holding that providers, it's their language, have a, quote, fundamental duty to enable patients to make decisions for themselves, end quote. In spring of 2017, the New England Journal of Medicine, a local journal here, published an essay by Ronique Stahl and Ezekiel Emanuel. You may remember that Dr. Emanuel was the most prominent physician in the Obama administration. And in that, they asserted that healthcare providers, again their language, quote, have a primary interest to promote the well-being of patients, end quote. This defines what they call the physician's role morality. And adhering to that morality means, in their terms, quote, offering and providing accepted medical interventions in accordance with patients' reasoned decisions. And in January 2018, and again last May, federal courts in Ontario upheld a new rule that comes out of the College of Physicians and Surgeons there, which has the authority of the law, authority of the state behind it, a rule that requires physicians to take positive action to make an effective referral for all legal interventions that a patient might request, including euthanasia and including abortion. What do we make of these developments? How should we think about the place of conscience and conscientious refusals in the good practice of medicine? So I'm going to do my best to unpack this with you guys, and I'll just tell you up front that I'm going to argue that conscientious refusals, which include both of the refusals I started with, both for antibiotics and for abortion, referral for abortion, are not instances in which a doctor's personal domain or personal values is intruding upon the so-called professional domain. Rather, these kinds of refusals are part and parcel of a doctor contending for, as a professional, contending for good medicine. Moreover, I'll propose that conscientious practice, which includes refusing to do anything that you believe, all things considered, you ought not to do, offers the best hope for good medicine, especially in a world in which there's deep disagreement about what good medicine includes. So that's where we're going. Let's start up front with a frequently overlooked fact. Namely, good doctors regularly refuse patient requests. This is often just sort of overlooked. And they refuse patient requests even when patients request an intervention that is legal, it's not forbidden by the state, and even a request for something that the profession itself permits. Now, doctors' refusals based on ethical grounds are not new. In ancient Greece, as probably most of you know, physicians who took the Hippocratic Oath, that was not all physicians to the best of our knowledge, but those who took the Hippocratic Oath promised to refuse requests for abortifacients and for any drug or information that someone might use to help kill patients. They refused these at a time when both of these practices were widespread in Greek society. Now, today, physicians still refuse things that they believe will harm patients, and they refuse things that they believe are not medically indicated. Surgeons often refuse to operate if they believe a surgery is unlikely to be successful. And they'll make that refusal, even when they know that three of their four partners would probably go ahead with the surgery. Primary care physicians refuse requests for antibiotics when they think the patient has a common cold. You guys probably have been taught already that that's good practice. And we see that in the case of Mr. Anderson. Sometimes doctors refuse things because of concerns that are less tangible, but no less real. Some Catholic physicians refuse to provide contraceptives because the Catholic Church teaches that contraception is illicit. More commonly, doctors' intangible concerns are not distinctively theological or religious. So a pediatrician may refuse to prescribe growth hormone injections for a boy who's particularly short because she's concerned about crossing over into enhancement rather than being focused on the health of the boy. Some primary care physicians will refuse intensive diagnostic workups when patients come to them with a lot of somatic syndromes that they don't think such workups are going to help solve. They want to be good stewards of their colleagues' time and other resources. OBGYNs who might abort a fetus that has a lethal congenital anomaly will sometimes refuse to abort a fetus that has Down syndrome or cleft palate out of concern to avoid perpetuating societal prejudices toward those with disabilities. All this is to say that doctors refuse patient requests. Refusing patient requests is and has always been central to the practice of medicine. So if that's true, critics like Emmanuel and Stahl and Savulescu and the policy writers in the Ontario College of Physicians and Surgeons, they can't be opposing all refusals, but only those that are conscientious. So what then makes a refusal conscientious? The term conscientious means, according to Merriam-Webster, simply governed by or conforming to the dictates of conscience. Well, then what's the conscience? Let me stop there for a second. What do you guys think the conscience is? I want to take a stab at that. Yeah.
Your sense of right and wrong.
Okay, your sense of right and wrong. You over.
Yeah, what we believe.
Okay. What we believe about what? Okay, all right. Okay, good. Let me say first, before I define conscience in a simple way, let me say what conscience is not. The conscience is not. The conscience is not a repository of beliefs. It's not a list of dogmatic assertions that we happen to affirm. Even something like my belief that elective abortion is always unethical, or that assisted suicide is a practice that violates physicians' profession, or that healthcare financing should prioritize support for those with disabilities. Any kind of opinion like that, that is not, those are not sort of a repository of beliefs that make up my conscience. They're not judgments of conscience. They're judgments of our intellectual capacities that are different from conscience. Conscience is also not a window to God's perspective on the world. So I can make a judgment conscientiously. I can make a decision about what I should or shouldn't do and be wrong. Rather, the conscience is simply the human faculty of reason that judges the moral quality, the goodness or badness, the rightness or wrongness, of our own actions, past or future, our own specific, particular actions. Should I go hear this lecture? Yeah, I think I should. I really don't want to. I want to just chill. I think I should. Okay, that's a judgment of conscience. Should I write that prescription or not write that prescription? Any kind of judgment about how you, the person whose conscience it is, have acted in the past or are thinking about acting, That's what the conscience is. It's that capacity that makes those judgments. To say that a doctor's refusal is conscientious is simply to say that the refusal is based on the physician's best judgment about what he or she ought to do in a given case, all things considered. The judgment need not be based on religious reasons or emotions or being able to sleep at night or personal concerns. It just means conscious refusals are merely refusals based on what the physician believes are good reasons. Reasons that make the difference to the physician in the particular situation that the physician faces. Now, critics of such refusals often presume that refusals based on medical or professional reasons don't belong in the category of conscientious objections or conscientious refusals. They see them as distinct. They're refusals based on medical reasons, and then they're conscientious refusals. So in their understanding, if I refuse Mr. Anderson's request for antibiotics because I think he has a common cold, then my refusal is not a conscientious refusal. It's a refusal based on medical reasons. As I'll mention, as I will indicate momentarily, this pattern of separating judgments of conscience from judgments based on professional obligations is highly problematic. I think it's ultimately unsustainable. I'll explain that in a second. In the meantime, all of us have seen in our plural world that two conscientious persons can disagree about what ought to be done in a given case, and they often do disagree. And those disagreements highlight, again, an important point. Two points, really. One, the conscience judges one's own actions. It's not a claim about... So when a person decides abortion is unethical for clear reasons, that's not a judgment of conscience, although that's an important ethical judgment. But when the person decides, in this case, I cannot participate in or cooperate in or facilitate an abortion, I can't act in the way that I'm being asked to act, I can't do the thing that's right in front of me as a possibility, that's a judgment of conscience. Second point, my refusal, the fact that my refusal is conscientious does not imply that my refusal is justified. So an appeal to conscience is not some kind of trump card. I don't have to do this because I have a conscience objection. Conscience as a human faculty is both limited and fallible. Back to our examples. I can practice medicine conscientiously and still fail in my ethical obligations to treat Mr. Anderson's illness, his respiratory illness. I might fail because I don't believe that treating pneumonia, bacterial pneumonia, in people like Mr. Anderson, smokers, you know, laborers, is important. In that case, I would fail because of a malformed conscience. I haven't been taught and trained to value things that I ought to value. Alternatively, I might fail, and this is much more likely, of course, I might fail because I mistakenly conclude that Mr. Anderson's infection is only viral. That I mistakenly conclude that he will not benefit from antibiotics. But in that case, I would fail because of a misinformed conscience. It's not that I don't value things correctly, it's that I just don't have the right information, don't have access to it. So a malformed or a misinformed conscience will lead me astray, and for that reason, one of our ethical responsibilities, a central ethical responsibility, is to form our consciences, or each of us to form our own conscience, through seeking out truth. Both about the content of morality, or ethics, as well as about the relevant factors that bear on a particular situation. So, for example, when a new practice, say, such as gender transition or gender-affirming services becomes available, and a pediatrician newly faces the question, how do I respond to reports in my practice to symptoms of gender dysphoria? Well, she should do her best to seek out the truth regarding this phenomenon. The procedures being offered, whether the courses of action available are consistent with the patient's good and with her vocation as a physician, so on. Because insofar as she wrongly understands these matters, her conscience will wrongly judge how she ought to act in the circumstances she faces. So again, the conscience, being a human capacity, is fallible, just as human vision is fallible. And yet, just as you can't keep a car on the road by shutting your eyes, you know, if you have imperfect vision, the answer to that is not to just close your eyes. In the same way, you can't discern how to practice medicine without practicing according to conscience. And specifically, a physician cannot discern whether she should accommodate or refuse the request of Mr. Anderson, Ms. Parker, anyone else,
except by exercising the physician's conscience and following its judgments. So if refusing requests is part and parcel of good medicine, which I think it clearly is, obviously so, and if conscience is the capacity a physician uses when judging whether she should or should not refuse a particular request that's in front of her, then it seems that critics cannot reasonably oppose conscientious refusals per se. What then do they oppose? What is getting people stirred up about these refusals? The problem is that physicians have professed to fulfill their professional obligations, to fulfill the obligations that come with being a doctor. And it seems to me people can reasonably hold us as physicians to fulfilling what it is that we have publicly professed to do, what they can reasonably understand us to have committed to when we decided to put on the white coat. After all, as Stahl and Emanuel put it, doctors are not conscripts. No one here was drafted to go to medical school at Harvard. No one's compelled to become a doctor. In choosing to become a doctor, one willingly takes on responsibilities that go with being a doctor. What Stahl and Emanuel call physicians' role morale. None of us would countenance a teacher in Harvard Medical School who refused to grade your work. Right? I want to be a teacher, I insist on being a teacher, but I can't in good conscience grade anybody's work. We wouldn't countenance an attorney who refused to gather information and to represent his or her client before the court. I want to be an attorney, I want to get paid, but I can't do all that work of trying to figure out how to defend my client, and I'm certainly not going to go deal with the hassle of the court. So why then, if that's true, would we allow physicians to show up as physicians and refuse what patients request for legal services that the profession allows? To put it bluntly, if conscientious refusals characteristically involve a physician refusing to fulfill some component of her professional obligations, then such refusals indicate, at least with respect to that component, that the physician cannot, in good conscience, be a physician. If conscientious refusals are refusals to fulfill one's professional obligations, then it seems to me Savulescu is right. Emanuel and Stahl are right. Those physicians should not be doctors, or they should at least avoid the areas of medicine in which they can anticipate that patients will request interventions that they cannot in good conscience provide, if that's true. But to know whether it's true, we need some criteria by which we can distinguish a refusal that's consistent with one's professional obligations. We already said, we know doctors have to be able to refuse some things. How do we know which refusals are consistent with our professional commitments and distinguish those from refusals that contradict our professional commitments? If we're going to find those criteria, we have to figure out what it is that physicians are obligated to do, what they reasonably profess when they commit to being a physician. And here's the rub. Physician refusals that occasion controversy do so precisely because they expose deep disagreements about what medicine is for, about what you reasonably profess. Now, is there any consensus that we can about something that medicine is for that could give us a starting point, something that we can all agree physicians simply must do if they're to continue as physicians? I'll say this. It has been self-evident to people from virtually every culture and every moral community throughout the centuries that physicians must care for the sick, seeking to restore their health. This seems like a universally recognized obligation. And it still provides a powerful criterion by which we can discern that some refusals, however conscientious, are incompatible with being a doctor. They're incompatible with good medicine. For example, consider a physician who refuses to care for patients with HIV because he doesn't like homosexuals, or refuses to care for black patients because of racial bigotry, or refuses to care for criminals because of offense and repulsion at their crimes. These refusals, it seems, violate physicians' constitutive professional obligation, their singular profession, to seek the health of the one who is sick without respect to, without regard for, the patient's other characteristics. I've not met someone who disagrees with that idea. I'm sure there's someone out there. That seems like a really place where we're not, don't have a lot of controversy. This obligation, though, to seek the patient's health does not provide a criterion by which one can condemn the sorts of refusals that have stirred so much controversy in the past 10 to 20 years. Rather, what's happened is, if we look back over the past two generations, really, from the 60s to the present, physicians have come to use medical technology in all sorts of ways that are not so obviously directed to preserving and restoring health. Arguments can be made about any of these technologies, but these are lots of technologies that are not obviously related to and directed toward the patient's health. Now, examples include, obviously, the practice of physician aid in dying. Practices like making short children taller, or fast athletes faster, reshaping buttocks and breasts and noses and chins and every other thing, changing secondary sex characteristics to match a gender identity or expression, helping people have babies using in vitro fertilization, aborting unwanted fetuses, and so on. But interestingly, the paradigmatic example of such interventions is actually the least controversial, namely contraceptives. In 1979, two decades after the FDA approved the first oral contraceptive, two of my mentors and teachers at the University of Chicago, Mark Siegler and Ann Dudley Goldblatt, neither of whom has any ethical objection to contraception, wrote the following. Quote, "The oral contraceptive was the first prescription drug that was and is, in effect, self-prescribed treatment. Patients, i.e. medical consumers desiring elective medication, demanded that physicians prescribe the contraceptive pill. Other popularly self-prescribed medications soon followed, and came to be seen as appropriate solutions or treatments for problems previously considered individual or social concerns, but in any case, not biological abnormalities or specific diseases." Now, it's not surprising that doctors participated in contraception and other non-health-directed uses of medical technology. Not surprising, because doctors have the expertise, right? You guys have all this training to understand the body, to understand physiology, and you are authorized by the state, with the power of the prescription pad, the power to write orders, the power to have privileges in hospitals. You have the capacity to do these things, the social power to do these things. However, despite doctors getting involved in all kinds of such practices, minorities of physicians over these decades have continued to refuse to engage in them, arguing that the practices are not required by and often conflict with their professional obligations to seek the patient's health and only the patient's health. What's happened is, in recent years, a growing chorus of figures is arguing that these refusals had just gone on too long, and the doctors must now provide or facilitate access to all legal and professionally accepted medical technologies, notwithstanding their personal moral objections. I'll just say here parenthetically that it's often suggested that somehow these refusals are a new thing, that they're part of a new kind of maybe Trumpian movement of people trying to impose personal values whereas they used to respect science. That's just a clearly false narrative. There's never been a time in American medicine where doctors were pressured to participate in abortion, or pressured, frankly, even to write contraceptives, pressured by their professional bodies, or to participate in assisted suicide. All of that pressure is new. So let's go back, however, to our cases. You know, why is it that this chorus does not condemn the doctor refusing Mr. Anderson antibiotics? And are antibiotics legal? Does the profession permit people to write antibiotics in cases like Mr. Anderson's? Yes. And the reality is a large minority of physicians, maybe even a majority, I don't know, would prescribe antibiotics in that case. So why are people not stirred up? Why is it that refusing Ms. Parker's request for a referral for abortion stirs much more outrage? Here, critics of conscientious refusals introduce a new distinction, according to which the physician who refuses Mr. Anderson's request for antibiotics is justified because the physician refuses for medical or professional reasons, and therefore he's upholding or being consistent with his role morality. In contrast, this reasoning goes, the physician who refuses Ms. Parker's request for a referral for abortion is to be condemned for allowing his personal and private concerns to intrude upon what should be a strictly professional consideration. I cannot overstate how important this alleged distinction is between the personal and professional to critics of conscience. Indeed, every criticism of conscientious refusals that I have read, and I have read scores of them in the medical literature over the past 15 years, every criticism invokes and leans heavily on an alleged clear division between the personal and the professional, posed in different ways. Some authors will talk about personal moral values versus professional ethical obligations, or personal conscience versus professional conscience, or personal integrity versus professional integrity, or personal beliefs versus professional responsibilities. Stahl and Emmanuel in the New England Journal piece captured the current thinking. Physicians may believe what they will in their private lives, they wrote, but in their role as healthcare professionals, they must provide the appropriate interventions as specified by the medical profession. End quote. So, in this way of thinking, physicians who conscientiously refuse a patient's request are thereby allowing personal biases to interfere with their professional obligations, and particularly their obligation to respect and to accommodate patient choices, patient autonomy. Here again is the challenge. How do you as a physician or medical student, how do you discern whether your refusal is based on reasons that are sufficiently medical or professional rather than merely personal? Critics have to date provided no non-arbitrary standard to guide those judgments. So rather than asking whether, for example, a refusal is consistent with a commitment to the patient's health, traditional orientation of medicine, instead critics put the burden of proof on the physician to show that their refusal is not influenced by their personal values. So for example, with abortion, the worry would be, the question is providing an abortion something that's required by my commitment to the patient's health? Rather, the question is, can you show us in a way that we can have confidence that this refusal is not motivated at all by your personal aversion to and belief that abortion is unethical? Doctors who allow personal values to influence their professional practices, these critics allege, thereby abuse their power and threaten harm to the patient. And harm here according to what standard? Not the standard of bodily health, objectively construed, but instead the standard of well-being, as subjectively determined by the patient. So the working assumption, rarely argued, is that if a patient makes an informed request for an intervention, then that intervention is good for him. It is necessary for his well-being, as he perceives it. Does this distinction between the personal and professional hold up under scrutiny? I think you're probably getting the sense that I don't think it does, and here's why. When a critic claims that a particular refusal is based on personal values, that, it seems to me, merely begs the question, the relevant moral question, what are physicians' professional obligations in this case? It can't make sense to be against, it can't make sense to ask doctors to fully separate their personal values and personal commitments from their professional practices. If we took that approach, we would have to ask the doctor who personally values caring for the underserved to go work in a wealthy suburb to make sure that his personal values don't influence his professional practice. We'd have to ask the physician who personally values and enjoys and feels good at using her hands. One thing she's got to do is avoid surgery, because we don't want her professional practice to be in any way confused with her personal predilections. This is obviously would be absurd. So we're back to, well, which personal values then should a physician separate from their practice? And the reply comes, you have to separate those values that keep you from fulfilling your professional obligations. But that only brings us back where we started. There's like a circular, there's a circular argument going on here. Unless and until we can specify our professional obligations, we simply cannot know which obligations are merely personal. As such, those who frame conscientious refusals as a conflict between personal values and professional obligations, what they're doing is they're taking one side in an argument that they rarely acknowledge. An argument about what medicine is for. So I'm going to restate this for emphasis. If you look below the surface of every controversy about conscientious refusals, a particular conscientious refusal, you will find a disagreement about what medicine is for and what physicians reasonably profess. On what my colleague Chris Tolleson and I call the provider of services model, what medicine is for is patient well-being, where well-being is understood principally in terms of the patient's considered informed choices being accommodated. It follows in the provider of services model that a clinician is professionally obligated to provide interventions that patients request, so long as the interventions are legal, feasible, and consistent with the patient's sense of well-being. Now that might seem like, this provider services model may seem like a caricature. Many physicians who are critical of conscientious refusals will say that they do not merely give patients what they want. Rather, they're committed to maintaining professional standards, doing what is clinically indicated, being evidence-based, and so on. That is so reflects the fact that although the provider of services model has been growing in influence over the past two generations, it continues to coexist with a time-tested vision of medicine that still guides physicians' intuitions and practices in many, if not most, domains. We call that time-tested vision the way of medicine. And in it, medicine is a paradigmatic practice elevated to a profession because of its social importance that aims at the health of the patient. On the way of medicine, a practitioner is professionally obligated to seek the patient's health and to refuse to engage in any action that contradicts that profession. The way of medicine seems to have much in its favor. First, it's supported by the considered opinions and the practices of wise practitioners of this art for thousands of years. You go back to Aristotle, whose father was a doctor, who wrote, "Now, as there are many actions, arts, and sciences, their ends also are many. The end of the medical art is health. That of shipbuilding is a ship. That of strategy, victory. That of economics, wealth." So Aristotle could take these as starting points for ethical reasoning. These are things that everybody knows, that are self-evident. Similarly, the Hippocratic Oath includes a promise to enter homes only, quote, on behalf of the sick, end quote, implying that medicine's fundamental aim is to restore the health that is imperiled in the sick. And countless practitioners of medicine before and after have made the patient's health their goal. Second, and related, the way of medicine is implicitly affirmed by the practices and commitments of physicians and patients today across diverse moral communities. So, as we said, today medical technologies can be applied to pursue many different goals. We can pursue family planning, a timely death, shaping the body in one way or another. And with respect to these goals, religious and other moral traditions have long disagreed. If medicine were understood as a practice of pursuing goals, these goals, there would be no shared medical profession any more than there's a shared clergy profession. The commitment to seek healing for those who are sick, however, is central to Judaism, to Christianity, to Islam. It came about and was recognized in the pagan world of ancient Greece. It's championed equally by those who do not consider themselves religious at all. Indeed, I've never met a colleague to this point who challenges the notion that one of at least physicians' central concerns is the patient's health. Third, the way of medicine responds aptly to the particular vulnerability that patients face. And we think it evokes the kind of solidarity and commitment that makes medicine the practice it is. So if you think about the experiences of those who are sick, you can see that what they need is a skilled helper habituated by a resolute commitment to seek their healing and to do so in solidarity with them as a person. This commitment allows those who are sick to entrust themselves to their doctors. And if patients can't entrust themselves to their doctors, doctors can't do their work. Now, I recognize that even if one agrees that medicine has a purpose and that the purpose is health, we still have to define health further. And I have worked to do that in other contexts in more depth, but for the present purposes, here's a key distinction I want you to keep in mind. In the provider of services model, health is only a subjective and socially constructed concept, what philosophers call an evaluative concept. Health is taken as marking the state of affairs that people happen to value. In the way of medicine, by contrast, health is meant in an objective sense. It's a bodily norm, a norm for all organisms according to their kind. It's what Leon Cass describes as the well-working of the organism as a whole. And it's manifest in the characteristic activities of the living body according to its life form. So, for example, we know what a healthy dolphin looks like. We know what a healthy squirrel looks like. And humans are more complicated, but not infinitely so. We know what characteristic activities are of a healthy human being. We believe this account captures the primary meaning of health, and health, so understood, grounds medical practice. It is the end, the purpose that medical practitioners must prioritize, and it's not to be abandoned or violated by those who profess a commitment to it, namely by doctors. So if that's true, physicians and other practitioners of medicine are always justified in refusing to act in ways that would intentionally damage or destroy the good of health. Indeed, they're professionally obligated to do so. Note also here that these two accounts, the provider services model and the way of medicine, coexist amicably, they even line up, wherever it's true that what the patient wants is for the practitioner to use her best judgment to pursue the patient's health, to care for the patient's health. And the fact is that that's what most patients want most of the time. But when we run into a conscientious refusal, what that exposes is that you hit a point where the two accounts are ultimately irreconcilable. In the end, these two accounts can't both be held as the authoritative account for what medicine is for. So we face a choice, and I'll kind of wrap up with this. I know some of you guys have to go in just a handful of minutes. The profession of medicine can continue to ask its members to commit themselves to an objective end, namely health. It's not subject to wholesale revision. And if this commitment is maintained, the profession would have to allow conscientious refusals where there is reason dispute about whether any particular intervention is consistent with that end. That'd be true for Mr. Anderson. It'd be true for Ms. Parker. Or the profession may constrain the scope of conscientious refusals and move toward more of a provider-consumer model in which physicians' moral and clinical judgment is frankly irrelevant to their task of providing what patients lawfully seek toward the patient's realization of his or her sense of well-being. We can't have it both ways, however. Unless we delude ourselves, I think we have to recognize that constraining the scope of conscientious refusals and moving toward more of a provider-consumer model will have major and potentially irreversible consequences for our profession. And I'll stop there and see if there's questions or comments from you guys. Yes.
So, in terms of psychological health, there are a lot of different ways you're evaluating, you know, how well a person is doing is based on their own subjective reporting. What is your advice or approach to those kind of scenarios where it's more of a subjective basis for evaluating as well?
No, thank you. The question's about mental health, where it seems like the basis for making judgments about mental health is necessarily subjective. That's the case. In fact, take it further, it's not just in mental health care. I mean, we ultimately have to depend a lot on what patients report about their experience. But we do that because we generally find that patients' reports about their experience are accurate. Generally, not always. What we don't do is assume that because a patient says it's so, it's so. Except about their subjective experience. But even mental health practitioners have to use judgment to decide whether the patient's subjective experience reflects an objective mental health disorder or not. And this points to some of the complexities of human health that mean it requires difficult judgments. It requires discernment. And it's not always going to be crystal clear what your commitment to the patient's health is going to require of you. But it seems to me what it can't require of you is that you just detach from making those judgments and just basically ask the patient, what do you want? In so many words. What psychoactive drugs do you think would be helpful for your well-being? And I'll write the prescription for you. Yes?
Do you not think the profession should constrain these questions as objections in some sense? So, like, instead of, as you say, if people are wrong, it's valid in some sense, what the public or the group of professionals agrees, this is incorrect for them to say something that everyone might agree with.
Well, yes, the profession has to have standards. We can't have a profession in which doctors can basically say, what I'm doing is governed by conscience, therefore it's beyond scrutiny. We have to be able to, there are some practices, however conscientious, we can't judge someone's motive ultimately, but however conscientious are incompatible with the profession. The key question to me is under what standard are we going to make those judgments? If the standard is one of the patient's health, that completely changes the footing. It completely reorients us towards something that's actually objective in the world that we can reason about together, and versus if our standard is well-being as the patient perceives it, then basically the onus is on us to justify why we're not going along with almost anything that persons request. Yes?
So you can conceive of situations where the profession might agree that abortion or some other sort of thing is in fact important for the person's health.
I think
you personally would disagree with, would argue against that not being for your health, like let's say the profession like happens to you.
Yeah, no, in effect, the profession can make more and less reasonable judgments and actions about what it is that medicine is for. So, for example, you can certainly imagine, we see it in Ontario, a profession deciding that the doctor is obligated to participate in killing the fetus, out of the doctor's obligation to reduce the risks of that come along with pregnancy. And that would be, so merely appealing to health doesn't make a policy justified, but that is a very different foot. The argument about whether participating in abortion is required by your commitment to health is very different from the argument about whether you're providing abortion is consistent with health as that person describes it. Because you then have a quick question about, well, what are we doing here, actually? What does the abortion do? Does it kill the fetus? And you'd have to face, well, how is killing the fetus consistent with my commitment to not damage or destroy the health of another? You have to question about, well, is the fetus another? And you have that debate. That's very different from, listen, patient, for the patient's well-being as they perceive it, this is needed, therefore you must do it. Is that beginning to answer?
Yeah.
Others?
Father Gregory?
A question, I guess, about health. So you mentioned Aristotle, my knowledge of medical science ceases in the 4th century BC, so he's like my expert, somewhat embarrassing, but here we are.
He wasn't so good on biology, but
yikes. So he talks about health as something that the doctor kind of deduces instrumentally, but that the primary motive power is supplied by the person, the universe self. And so I'm wondering if in that you have some like philosophical or conceptual resources for your governing paradigm, or if it will just get you entangled in a bunch of limit cases. Because I suspect that some therapies will actually circumvent the healing process of the body, because the ordinary healing process might not prove most conducive to health in the long run. But that there's probably something there that can be used. I just don't know any of the medical science, whether that actually affords you a conceptual resource to advance this notion of like the way of health. That it's something that the body is already working out, as it were, and that you, as a medical professional, are responsible for assisting or like inducing it, but only instrumentally, and that the primary agency is exercised by the person.
Yeah. I don't know fully how to answer that, except to say that it does seem to me that the fact of health in the world prior to medicine is the fact that we observe it, we see it, we esteem it, we pursue it prior to medicine is evidence that it is something that is not a good that medicine simply creates by its own orientation to whatever it thinks it wants to pursue, like the value of the concept of health can be. Well, health is that thing we pursue with medicine, as one might say. But whether that entangles me in a notion about whether health's primarily the responsibility of the patient and not medicine, I don't know. I have to talk about it more to figure that out. Yes?
What is... I think the reason a lot of people object to this sort of framework that you have is that it is very difficult for the profession because of the very various contexts that people live in. So you could think of very extreme examples of something where, let's say, someone from a community that's all blind or something comes in, the child's born not blind, but it's very helpful for the child to be born blind because it's useful in the cave or something like that. Or you come more complex examples of being a deaf person or something like that.
Yeah.
But it's very difficult for the community, for the profession itself, to determine what is healthy for in the particular different contexts, because then you lose a lot of exceptions and you lose a lot of you have only your personal lived experience. It's very difficult to come up with answers for that. So I think that's one of the difficulties.
Well, I mean, I think we can kind of overstate that. Clearly, there are difficult cases. There are places where it's hard to judge, where reasonable people will have disagreements about what health requires. But I don't think the fact that you have Harvard Medical School and Duke Medical School, and I think they're about the same business, and they read the same journals, and they train each other to work in a similar way, suggests that we think we all kind of know what health is in the great majority of cases. The fact that when you roll into the ER, people don't sit around going, well, what is it you want? But instead, they get busy, suggests that we operate with a deep, tacit confidence that we actually know quite a lot about health. I mean, there are the margin cases. We have to look at those, I think, individually. One is mental health is one. The question of whether something like abortion, where someone would argue, well, I'm pursuing their health because I think of the fact that carry a pregnancy to term is a higher risk of death for that woman than to have an abortion now at 7 weeks. So that's what I'm doing, is preserving their health. Then you have to think about whether the thing you're doing is itself unethical, even if the motive is a good motive. Yes.
So this framework, it sounds like if there are many, most circumstances in which a there is a very clear understanding of what is the good of the health of this patient. But in cases where there is no such clear understanding, or when people have in good conscience they disagree about what is in the health of the patient, that those kinds of cases, those unclear cases, these cases that are settled by people in good faith,
different. Yeah, I think it is unjust. Yeah, whenever the state requires of its people that they act in a way that is unjust, the state has it's an unjust policy. And obviously, we have to work this stuff out politically, and we all live under unjust policies in various forms. And so what ones that might catch your attention might be different than the ones that capture your neighbor's attention. But yeah, I think it's clearly an unjust policy. And note here, as you were, I think, starting to allude, that if the state and the profession give people space where there's reasonable disagreement about what commitment to health requires, what that does is keep alive in the profession a kind of ongoing self-criticism. And if I know that Bill is trained like me in my profession, and he thinks that this practice that a lot of people engage in is actually contradictory to health, and so he won't do it, then if I'm around Bill, every time I face that issue, I have to ask myself, why am I doing this? But if both Bill and I live under a regime in which we're told, stop presuming to bring your personal judgment into this, just do what people request, then you're essentially, the policy is cutting off the practice of self-criticism reducing the possibility that we can come to recognize that the thing we did yesterday wasn't actually very good. We should stop, as we've had to do over history numerous times. Yes.
I was wondering, so in these situations where people with these values are faced with their conscientious objections, but they're faced with a regime, or they're faced with a practice that would advocate or would be requiring them to sign a line or say something like, I need to be okay with abortions or with IVF or et cetera, how do people in the profession from our side, what is the best way for us to emit, like, sort of, are we called to political action then if you're in the medical field, or at least some form of collective action, and how is that best done, you say?
Good. I mean, the first step is just to commit, I'm going to be a good doctor. Even if people ask me to do things that I'm persuaded are not good doctoring, I'm not going to do it. I'm going to seek my patient's health. And then when people say, what the heck are you doing? You're refusing or doing something, I'm going to give them the best reason I know. I'm going to explain to them how the action is either consistent with my commitment to patient's health or not. That's the most powerful way to pursue good medicine, is to act. I think setting out, particularly as a student, in advance to persuade people that they should appreciate the thing that you'd like to be able to do is generally not going to be very fruitful, both because it puts people in defensive posture and because they won't take you seriously while you're in training. But a resolute, first of all, being hardworking in your pursuit of the patient's health and being committed to seeking the patient's health, seeking to heal only, never harm, and developing the capacity to talk about that has a powerful witness. And I will say, in my experience, evokes esteem. Even to people who might disagree with you about one position or another. I'll practically also say this. What I encourage students to do is don't get into the habit, which is very common, of talking about these things as if, you know, I have a personal value and I have a kind of conscientious objection to that thing. And I'm asking you guys to, you know, respect my personal values. That's the way often people go. And what that does is two things. It communicates implicitly to others that their way of thinking is right about what medicine requires,
and not to be taken for granted, but that you are, and second is, you're essentially saying to them, I'm not willing to be a doctor here, please let me be sort of a partial doctor. Both of those are false. So rather, what you want to do is say, you know, I want to be a good doctor. So someone says, do this thing. I don't think I can do that thing in good conscience. Why not? You have personal value? Well, actually, I want to be a good physician, and it seems to me that practice, I know it's common, but it seems to me that practice is actually contradictory to what medicine is for. It seems to be contradictory to my commitment to the patient's health. Oh, really? I find people, that gets people interested, and it evokes a conversation that they can respect. And it also makes them say, well, why are we doing that? Which is healthy for all of us. Yes.
Thanks for coming to speak. It's very interesting. So to sort of keep coming back to this, the one distinction we make that this is not a state, is that the distinction between health and well-being is the universal climate. It seems to me that people achieve their own personal notions of well-being, and that's just as positive benefits of their health on them, maybe in the future.
The question is about health and well-being, observing that when people achieve a state they consider well-being, that tends to have positive influences on health. Do I think ultimately these distinctions will be blurred? No, I don't think they will be. As I said before, what most people want to be healthy. I mean, I think everybody down deep wants to be healthy. And most of the time, their understanding of what healthy is aligns very much with the physician's understanding of what healthy is. And the both of their understanding aligns, I would argue, with the reality of health. So, for example, you encounter a squirrel. Let's go away from humans for a second. You encounter a squirrel, and you find that squirrel can't chatter, can't climb trees, doesn't beat its tail, doesn't bury nuts. What do you know about that squirrel? What? Okay, well, it's not dead, it's living. What do you know about it?
Not healthy.
It's not healthy. It's sick in some way. It's ill. You know that. You haven't done an x-ray. You haven't done an exam. You haven't done a lab. You haven't considered pathophysiology. You know there's something wrong. If you had a world in which squirrels can communicate, they have to be self-conscious. And the squirrel said, this is the way I want to be. Would that mean that that's the squirrel's health? Sometimes the word health is used to mean essentially flourishing. So, and I think that that's understandable when it's used analogically to say something like, well, what's a healthy marriage? What we mean there is, what's a flourishing marriage? What's a marriage that's going well, right? But it's being used analogically there. And that analogical use of health dovetails with a desire to be holistic, right? None of us wants to be too narrow. None of us wants to be dualistic. And so we can think, well, you know, I don't want to be just about reducing disease or, you know, fixing problems. I want to see patients flourishing, patients' well-being. And that's right. That's good insofar as it goes. But the problem is when we take that motivation and the analogical use of health, and we start to think either that health, that everything is doctor's domain. Anything that you're suffering, anything that you want my help with, it is my domain, and that I'm to pursue. Which essentially makes doctors into kind of, I think, a sort of grotesque, uber professional who has the presumption of being capable of pursuing the fullness of life on behalf of their patients. That's one problem. And then when we define health so broadly that it basically becomes the fullness of life, then we are making the mistake of suggesting that health is the only thing that makes lives worthwhile, that makes lives flourish. But health is that objective bodily norm. It's good in itself, but it's not everything. There's friendship, right? And that's important to some of you. If somebody in here said, you know, I'm going to go stick it to my friend. I'm going to betray them. Why? Because I think I'll be a little healthier. Even if it was true in some way, you think, well, that seems wrong. life is about more than being maximally healthy. There's friendship, there's work, there's all kinds of things that are good. And I think we have to both have a humble vision of what medicine is for, and we have to acknowledge that health is a real thing for living organisms like us, and that it's not the only thing for human well-being. It's not the only thing for human flourishing. I realize that we could talk about that a lot more.
Thank you.